Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and with me, as ever, is the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, remembering Gary Becker. So, Richard, since our last broadcast, Gary Becker, Nobel laureate in economics, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, also someone who moved in a lot of the same circles as yourself, faculty at University of Chicago, senior fellow here at Hoover, passed away at the age of 83. We'll get into some of his specific work in a little bit, but let's start big picture. For people who may not have been familiar with Professor Becker until the obituaries started running, how would you explain his significance? When George W. Bush gave him the Medal of Freedom in 2007, he called him one of the most influential economists of the past 100 years. Why? What makes him different?
Well, one of the reasons is actually if you look at his title. When he was at the University of Chicago, he was a professor of economics and sociology. And what made Becker different from just about everybody else is that he really thought that basic theories, very stripped down theories of individual rationality, applied with great force to ordinary social situations that most people did not think were part and parcel of economics. So the contrast between him, for example, and Ronald Coase was absolutely extraordinary. Ronald spent his entire life starting with a great article called The Nature of the Firm, explaining why it is when you're running a routine shop as a good Englishman, you will sometimes vertically integrate, or you'll basically form all the elements together in a single firm, or what you'll do is you'll contract out some of these services to independent contractors. And the great Coasean insight was that transactions costs would often determine the boundaries of a firm. And at one insight, has led to huge advances in industrial organization. Spoke to Ronald, that's what he was concerned with, businesses. Gary, most of his work does not come with ordinary businesses and ordinary transactions costs. What you might say is that Gary was one of the first people who unapologetically developed a theory of the economics of everyday life. Now, to some extent, this is actually reinventing the wheel. The original term economics has something to do in Greek with the notion of a household production. And I can still recall the time that I went to Mount Vernon. It was quite clear that Martha Washington was running a rather major firm on the premises because the goods that came into the firm tended, for example, to be cloth. And what she did was to organize the production of clothes out of that. And clearly, if she was running a mixture of family members and slaves, she was not doing this through standard mechanisms. Now, people sort of knew this, but it took somebody like Becker, and this is one of the reasons he's a great man, to figure out that, you know, there's a real lot of economic principles going on in this case. And simply because you don't have standard kinds of market exchanges, it doesn't mean that you can't use markets to explain the way in which these institutions start to work. And at that particular point, what you then do is to figure out the way in which rational, self-interested individuals play out in these kinds of interactive settings. Now, the assumptions that, in fact, apply to these cases are not quite right. Generally speaking, when you're in close communities like that, they're bonds of affection as well as bonds of rational arrangements. But the point that Becker always used to make is if you strip away some of the complexities and have a consciously oversimple model, you'll come into insights which may well survive when you start to make the model a little bit more complicated than it otherwise would have been. And so you listen to Gary starting to talk about how these family operations start to work. And he has exchange models that work between parents and children. I take care of you today, you'll take care of me tomorrow, and a whole variety of other things. And there's always a grain of truth with respect to the way in which they operate. When he talked about the family, he talked about the marriage market. And what we mean by the marriage market is how women and men get together, typically in monogamous relationships. But as Gary used to stress, there were many societies in which polygamous arrangements used to take place. And of course, if you think about it, they're market mechanisms. The famous yenta in Jewish situation, the matchmaker, if you want to call her that, is not the yenta, the matchmaker actually, is somebody who sort of interviews one person on behalf of others and tries to find eligible spouses for desirable women or eligible men or the other way around. And it turns out that they really are brokered arrangements. If you go back to earlier marriages, the creation of dowry, for example, as a condition of taking a woman into the family, the change in the order of hierarchy as the new wife may be subordinate in terms of her position in the social hierarchy for the to the mother of the groom, the extended Roman families with respect to paterfamilias, where you had all sorts of businesses that were done between brothers, neither of whom had legal personality. The moment you start to look at this family stuff, it turns out that the economics kind of comes out everywhere. And Becker was the person who essentially created this particular new field. One of the biographies or obituaries of Gary started to talk about him as an economic imperialist, and that's exactly the same term that I use quite independently in my little piece about him on Ricochet. He thought there was nothing to which this particular stuff did not apply. And so, you know, if you look at him, he is really very different from Coase for the reasons I've said. He's quite different from Milton Friedman, who is interested largely in major issues of monetary policy and perhaps the consumption function, rather different from George Stigler, who is interested in the way in which asymmetrical information organizes markets and what the relationship is between systems of regulation and system of private market behavior. So you have these four giants all doing kind of different things, but each of them essentially working off some variation of this rational choice model. And Becker was the youngest of these people and was, I would say, the most idiosyncratic. His influence will rest in the way in which he moved economics somewhere else. The other three men, their influence will rest in the way in which they made more traditional advances or greater advances, I should say, in more traditional fields.
Let's talk a little bit about that contrast with Friedman, because Becker was very open and acknowledged – he studied under him, was very open and acknowledging how deep of an influence that Friedman had on him. But we have both men now deceased, meaning we can consider each of their careers in full. So compare the two. I mean, how should we think of Becker's work relative to Friedman's? Where were they similar? Where were they different?
Well, I mean, they were very different kinds of people. Milton was always a man who was a public controversialist. In fact, at times, it got him into serious sort of tension with his lifelong friend George Stigler, who didn't think that somebody who's an economist should have a public face. He didn't think that somebody who's an economist should actually advise somebody like President Reagan or write a popular column for Newsweek magazine, which Friedman did for many years and which Becker followed when for 20 years he wrote his column in Business Week. And Milton had that. He also, I think, Milton had this sort of unerring eye on how to think of great themes which had real immediate practical application. Remember, Milton Friedman was the guy who invented, for better or for worse, the withholding tax system during World War II. Milton was the guy who dreamed up the draft and the question of turning it into a voluntary army. Milton was the guy who said that you could have the government finance education through vouchers without running these kinds of things. And all of these ideas have had an immense influence, I think, for the better with respect to the operation of public policy. Becker's work, for the most part, does not have any sort of obvious public policy implications. That is, now that you understand how polygamy starts to work, you're not going to see a huge movement in order to reinstitute it as a dominant form of marriage within the American culture. And in part for reasons that Becker explained, as women become stronger, they're not willing to take a subordinate position. So the old model in which dominant males would have multiple wives is much less attractive today when women have independent opportunities in the workplace and can help support any couple of which they start to become a part. So Gary never really, at least when Milton was alive, had that kind of public situation. After Milton's death, or even at the decline, Gary did start to have influence in a couple of areas, and let me mention them. One thing that Becker did extremely well was he was the sort of leading figure intellectually, now joined by Eddie Lazier, in trying to figure out how you create rational markets for immigration. You have people who want to bring skills to a company. Do you allow them to pay their way in and jump to the head of the queue, or do you decide that traditional modes in which immigration is based upon family conventions and connections or something or other ought to be the case? And, you know, the Becker influence with respect to policies, for example, in Canada was probably fairly pronounced, and he is certainly was a leading figure in the way in which you try to, as it do, immigration reform in the United States. The other thing is almost ironic is after Milton died, and he died, I think it was in 2006, we did have the great financial crisis of 2008. And the issue then with who would be the spokesman of sorts for the monetarist position that Milton entertained. And it turned out in many ways Becker actually assumed kind of contrary to his own natural inclinations, the defender of the view that whenever you look at what you perceive to be massive market failures, you always have to ask yourself whether the government failure that lurks over the next mountain is equal or greater in size to the one that just happened. And the New Yorker ran an interview that he had had some years ago about all of this, in which he said, yes, I know that there are a lot of bad things that happen with the market, but remember, lots of bad things, even worse things can happen when government starts to take over. I do not think that this was Becker at his very best. I think he was older at that time, and he had suffered, I think, for some kind of medical conditions. He was a very private man, so you could not find out exactly what they were. But it's clear in the last 10 years of his life that he was battling some cancer, a chronic kind of disease of one form or another. He did not do what Milton would have done in that particular case. Milton would have gone on the offense. He said, what are you talking about, private industry getting this stuff wrong in the way in which they put the derivatives? The real problem here is that the Fed said the interest rate's too low. It turns out that the subsidies through Fannie and Freddie of low-risk mortgages were absolutely a recipe for disaster, and it was just a matter of time before the whole thing managed to collapse. And if you want to figure out what the relative responsibilities are, it's one part private enterprise and nine parts government stupidity. There would have been a clear difference in the way in which these things started to work. Milton was essentially a natural publicist, and he had the ability to create great examples and sort of physical images. Gary was more cerebral. He was much more comfortable talking in workshops than he was talking in public settings, and I don't think you could get Gary to make the following kind of statement that Milton made. It's one of my favorites. It turns out, Milton says, well, you've got one imperfection. Now you're going to try to correct it with another. He says, that's really brilliant. He says, think of this. You've got a boat which has a hole in the bow, and the way in which you're going to correct the difficulty is to create a hole in the stern. That is, you could have a level playing field in which the boat sinks, or you could patch the first hole in order to keep it going. And that's a very profound insight, because it says that it's very dangerous business to try to offset one kind of imperfection by the creation of an equal and opposite imperfections. Almost invariably, it's like a train going off the rails. As you veer to the left, when you overcompensate, when you go back to the right, overcompensate again when you go back to the left, and eventually you just crash. And Milton had that kind of image capability. Gary was at his best in workshops. And I've been with him in many of them. He was just relentless. And oftentimes he kind of pushed everybody aside. And if he had a series of questions that he thought had to be answered, he would not let go of the floor. And he was sufficiently powerful intellectually, and that if you wanted to take the floor from him, you had to throw yourself in front of a moving train and then watch your body get put into two. I mean, he's a different kind of guy. Both of them were extraordinary figures, obviously.
Well, Richard, let's think for a minute about you. You mentioned this quartet: Becker, Friedman, Ronald Coase, George Stigler, all giants of free market economics. In Friedman's case, somebody, as you've mentioned, with a very elevated public profile. All of them now gone, and it's hard not to hear that. And then think of the contrast. Your column for Hoover this week was on Thomas Piketty, this French yes. economist, whose views could not be further removed from that quartet. Thinks income inequality is a pox on society, wants 80% marginal tax rates, global wealth tax, and his book is flying off the shelves. They can't keep it stocked. So does one look at that and think – all this work done intellectually by the Chicago School and other free market sources, all the effort that went into translating that into public policy, and the public seems to have either forgotten it or turned against it, or some combination of the two. Is that cause for despair, or does it just take the next Gary Becker or Milton Friedman to break through? Is this cyclical or something more enduring?
Well, it depends. Look, let's get this straight, I think, in terms of the history. One of the ways that we know that we're heading in a wrong direction is the term progressive, which was the dominant term describing the American interventionist left, its belief in the administrative state, the redistributive tax, government expertise, and so forth, reached its peak between about 1900 and about 1935, and resulted, in my view, in a series of calamitous statutes, many of which are still with us. The The revival preceded Piketty's book by a good deal. I mean, certainly the Obama election in 2008 indicated that there was now some real traction in this. What was the source of this traction? Well, in part, it was the crisis of 2008, where John McCain simply did not respond in a sensible fashion, wanted to postpone the debates and things like that. And Obama promised fresh hope of one kind or another. There were other people prior to Piketty. Emmanuel Saez, one of his buddies from France, a very important economist, was certainly out there with this material on income inequality for some years before this. If you look also at the American left, there's Paul Krugman, who's always in your face with this kind of information. People like Joe Stiglitz, another Nobel Prize winner, are very much out in that direction. So there is a very strong, high-profile American sort of left-wing economic tradition. The right wing has gone in a very different direction. Instead of talking about the virtues of market transactions and innovation and so forth, most modern Chicago-type economists are engaged in what I would call almost micro-plumbing. Here we have a board of directors, and we have to decide what's the appropriate ratio between inside directors on the one hand and independent directors on the other. And somebody will give you a modeled behavior which says 7-4 is better than 6-5 or something like that. And so what's happened is the concern that exist amongst market-type economists tends to be a micro-analysis of various kinds of inevitable imperfections. This was actually started to some extent by people like George Stigler, who says, you know, asymmetrical information can distort choices in markets. It was increased by the famous work that was done on agency costs, where the fundamental asymmetries were identified by Meckling and Jensen in 1976. So there's always a conflict of interest between the principal and the agent of a firm. And you know, my reaction to those things is that's what markets are about. They understand that these conflicts arise, and then they develop institutions and checks in order to deal with them. But what's happened is the microeconomists of the Chicago School love to talk about the imperfections. The people on the left love to talk about the global injustices. So there's nobody out there with sufficient clarity and power to sort of say, you know, if you look at the standard stock market, you look at the standard agricultural exchange, if you look at the levels of innovation that take place through patents and technology, this is an amazing successful society. In the little column I did on Piketty, I said, look, forget about wealth for a second. Just look at well-being. I'm going to give you a crude measure of well-being, which is that the life expectancy in the United States has gone up by 30 years in the last 115, give or take, right? And that for the black population in the United States has gone up by 40-plus years. Now, maybe you think it's all concentrated in the top 1%, so that the longevity period is for people whose income is $1 billion or more, their wealth is $1 billion or more, they're up there at 8,472 years. But the whole point about these measures is, by definition, the only way you can raise the average is to raise everybody. There's just no way you could concentrate those gains in the top portion of the population. And, you know, the same economists who say, don't look at GDP slavishly, think about happiness. When somebody says, well, here's a perfectly good proxy for happiness, longevity, it's not perfectly correlated, but we can then talk about morbidity as another one. These indices have shown such massive improvements across the length and breadth of the population that it's fair to say that a person today who is born in the bottom fifth in the United States has better prospects for longevity and good health than somebody born in the top 1% 115 years ago. They might not have fine China and rare hors d'oeuvres, but they're probably going to live longer, they're going to probably have better health care, and they're probably going to have higher levels of satisfaction because they're going to have fewer aches and pain. I mean, these achievements seem to get lost. And, you know, my own life is now trying to create a crusade on this stuff. One-man crusade, not very impressive, but in October of 2010, I did go on the PBS, and I was there defending inequality, and I can still remember the lead into this show. Paul Solomon tells me, he says, well, he said, we had to find somebody for this show who was going to think that inequality wasn't bad. We couldn't find any reputable economist, so we ended up with you. I mean, that's the way in which the actual thing come. And, you know, you could look at the tape. They tape me in very close. They have me talking at a mile a minute. It's a style which will obviously alienate some people because of its intensity and so forth. But it was, I think, a real deviation from the standard norm, because I thought that if you wanted to talk about markets and governments, ask yourself the question, did the governments figure out the cure for diabetes? Did it figure out the way in which you get vitamin deficiencies controlled by simple food, all of this stuff? No. Did it build sewers? Darn right that it did, and that was exactly the kind of function that took place at the height of laissez-faire. In fact, the first wave of longevity increases, 1850 to 1900, is essentially cleaning up public water supplies in similar situations. Second one, 1900 to about 1935, 1950, it tends to be vitamins, it tends to be infectious diseases of one kind or another, all of which you could handle at low life. Trying to figure out what to do with Alzheimer's disease and with cancers, it's a lot harder to do it, and you get a lot less bang for your buck. I mean, that's just the way in which the system is organized. And I think that what's so appalling about the Piketty book is his complete indifference to and probably ignorance of all of these particular kinds of transformations. That's the advantage of being a lawyer. You actually get your hands dirty when you read cases that involve the FDA, the EPA, the SEC, all these agencies. And when you look at them up close and personal, they don't come up looking as nice and smelling as sweet as you might have otherwise thought to have been the case.
All right, Richard, thank you as always, and thanks to our listeners. Remember, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. You can buy his most recent book, The Classical Liberal Constitution, The Uncertain Quest for Limited Government, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.